wanted to do today to share a first impression. I want to try and put together two different texts that I've taught on numerous occasions and see whether they play, see how they play out, at least if we get to the second text. The first is an article by Professor Noam Zohar in his book Alternative to Jewish Bioethics. And this was originally the introduction to medical ethics class, but it turned out probably to be too hard. But I figured I can try it with this group, which raises a really profound challenge, not just to bioethics, but to any notion of the interconnection of halakha and an independent standard of value. And you can use loaded terms, you can use loaded terms Judaism and ethics, but the real question underlying it is, can Judaism acknowledge a source of value that is independent of halakha, or particularly independent of Judaism? And I want to try not to fudge that question the way I think Lichtenstein does in the same speech. If they have to depend on halakha, right, then you define your terms, you take your chances. Lichtenstein in that article is taking what you might call a phenomenological approach. Is there material that we identify as binding in Judaism, which nonetheless, or meritorious in Judaism, which does not have formal halakhic expression? And he fudges that question by saying, guess what, there's an area of quasi-halakhic expression. Which is the Ramban's penumbra, fundamentally identical to the Ramban's penumbra of things surrounding Shabbat Shabbaton and Lefita Tov HaYashar and the Eitam Kedoshim. Just put that into the category with the Shirat Hadid. He doesn't address the question of whether halakha itself is answerable to an answerable to values outside itself. Okay, I tend to think that's the question that really should be addressed, right, except in the Mosai, where he talks about Omer Lishma. Now, the reason that people want to address that is that if you believe that there is a standard of, I went ahead. If you believe that there is a standard of value which is external to halakha, and even more particularly, if you believe that the standard of value which is external to halakha may be epistemologically derived subjectively from sources outside of Torah. Okay, meaning that in the end, I think it is necessary in Orthodox Judaism to contend that all values have their place in Torah. Some notion of a posta de kulaba applies in the level of to emerge with a value and concede that value has no source of Torah, I think is a very difficult claim to make within Judaism. It's possible. It's possible, yes, obviously. A claim that something is worth something.
For example,
being nice to animals. Well, that's a claim. There's a value claim. That being nice to animals is a worthwhile act. Right? The strongest form of the question is which Lichtenstein's phrase is there an ethnic independent halakha means are there things that you're supposed to do that aren't halakhic? And that fudges the question. The word binding is already a complicating term. That already adds to the question. The question might be, is are there worthwhile acts that aren't binding? Right, you can ask the question that way. Right. Now you could make the claim that the good is independently binding on you. Right, and that's the challenge or Lichtenstein is trying to face in his piece is if it's a good thing to do then of course it's binding, and it's binding in what sense is it not awesome? Right? Everything you have to do with it, right? That's what all it is, the things you have to do. Right? So little things that isn't comfortable making a distinction between the formally and the informally binding. Okay?
But what does he say in the source of that good?
He doesn't really answer that question. He tells you that for your purposes, you can view it as halacha because there are sources in halacha which are vague enough that they can encompass any notion of value you might have. Like the attempt to assume will encompass all aspects of holiness, and the thing that will encompass all interpersonal ethics. The question of how you know, right? Since the attempt to assume is not particularly specific, but that I don't think is a question that he addresses in great depth.
And you've got to, but you feel the need to find a purpose for it.
So he talks about the challenges of natural, you know, derived from natural law, derived from reason, right? Those are, right, you know, but I don't think in the end that's not his primary, you know, in fact, I think in the end he concedes that that there are lots of Gemaras which seem to indicate that some kind of intuition works, right? I don't think it's a fair summary, but the real issue he's trying to address is finding some kind of way of reconciling a vision which sees halacha as comprehensive with a recognition that people who only follow Shulchan Aruch are already convened in the Limur Shulchan Aruch. Yes, Abby.
Yeah, another
question.
Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of reflexivity in halacha in the sense of, like, halacha will say, is also, like, recognizing that there's sources outside of halakha, sources of value outside of halakha, and to then characterize those sources of value outside of halakha as halakha, because
well, again, that's the move that Lichtenstein is making by creating these vague categories. Now, the problem I always had with this article, and this is my kind of article on satisfying, although I was very grateful for it, but I reflected on early Shema, is that the underlying, right, the risk, the reason people don't want to acknowledge a source of value outside halakha is that once you acknowledge it, it runs the question of what happens if they conflict. And is it possible they can flee? Right? That's the question that isn't addressed in that case. I tend to be most interested in that question, which is, you can frame it as that there is a source of value, but you presume that source of value only has space where halakha leaves blank. You can frame it as that source of value influences the development of halakha, although if halakha has regenerated, has developed in different directions, has no right, all ways of evading it. Yes, John?
If I'm right,
God,
I mean,
the Lichtenstein
doesn't deal with it. He just rejects the possibility of the notion.
Okay,
we'll put
note 5.
Okay, we'll hear
the Shema.
Put note 5, yeah. Where he says,
as far as
we don't accept anything.
Yes, and that's
what
is wrong, though. But look at Ron's case, but I'm talking, yes. I addressed that directly.
There's another article where he rejects the notion more explicitly, you know, or talks about how it wouldn't actually be a problem. I mean, you know, right?
Okay. I think that it's not totally unfair to say that Lichtenstein is made deeply uncomfortable by that notion, and there is a chance to address it. But most people who are deeply uncomfortable with that notion do not have the counter pressure of being aware that they derive value from sources outside of Torah because they really care about the Torah literature. So Lichtenstein doesn't have the way to help other people have, and that generates a very nuanced position. You can claim, like, just for example, say that, you know, that there are sources, but they're always subject to halakha, they only fit in the spaces beyond halakha. You can claim that actually all these things are just direct development of Torah anyway, they're just, and they fit into the vague things, but they're just, they've got halakhic crystallizations of agadic material, right? So there are ways out which don't work as well for a local scene. I think I would phrase it that way. And I take this on directly in various other contexts. What goes on here, though, in Zohar, is not writing, as a local scene addressed in that article phenomenologically, Right? Are there things in Judaism which have value or may derive level obligation that can't be directly derived from the formal halakhic system? Zohar Joe addresses the article in a much more theoretical framework, suggesting that there is a fundamental conflict between the notion of Jewish obligation and the notion of ethics. And the way he frames it, when he thinks that applies to, so he says that there are two different kinds of claims. One is that the definition of ethics is what he called the universalist objection. Right? The universalist objection says that ethics means things that apply to all human beings in the same way and are accessible to all human beings. Things that are binding all human beings in the same way. Right? It's a constitutional principle. Right? You can't take into account its creed or sexual orientation when you're thinking about whether an obligation is binding. And the second one is that they have to be universal in access. They call universality in scope and access. And that, right, universal in access means that everybody has to be able to derive them. It can't depend on culturally specific knowledge. Okay, whereas ethics have to be, ethics have to be standardized exams, whereas they're not dependent on cultural background. He argued, therefore, that this point, I think, is critical to understanding the introduction of Kuzari, in which the Kuzari fundamentally rejects all universally binding religions on the grounds that nothing can be binding unless there is universal access to it. You can't make something binding on people who couldn't know what was binding on them. And therefore the Kuzari has the apparently comic rejections of Islam and Christianity, right? But Islam is the most interesting one. Right? It says reject Islam because the reason people should know that Islam is binding is because the Quran is the most beautiful book ever written, as our friend mentioned last Wednesday night, and he said, I don't read Arabic. And people think this is coming, it's not coming. They said, I don't read Arabic. Lots of people don't read Arabic. Therefore, lots of people have no way of knowing that the Quran is binding, because they can't tell that it's sacred. Therefore, Islam can't be binding on them, but Islam claims to be binding on all people, therefore Islam is false. Right? It's a very nuanced argument. And the court, the Kuzari, this is a separate hearing, listen to this, I think it has this online. The core argument of the Kuzari is that what makes Judaism compelling is that it doesn't claim to bind anybody but Jews. And that there is a way, he argues, which is memory, right? There's a way in which one can contend plausibly that all Jews ought to know that halacha is binding on them, which is not true for anyone else regarding any other system. Yes, sir?
What about also the question
of
the
opposite
of the rejection? And
would you
see that as being a necessary step in the
Jewish religion? No. I mean, it's a useful proof for him, right? But look, you're trying to say that he didn't accept it, it's not binding. His interest is not autonomy. His interest is epistemological access. And the problem he's trying to deal with is, why is it that the Torah is binding on us because of the revelation of Sinai? Right? So how is it that we know the revelation of Sinai? Right? It's subject to history. Right? It's subject to history. So he makes a distinction, which is then pulled out, right, which Yosef Yerushalmi remakes again, this was before, between memory and history. And he argues that the revelation of Sinai is memory for Jews, and it's plausible to expect people to act on the basis of the basis of memory, because memory is the basis of identity, and identity is the identity is the source of everything. Given this is addressed, it's much more substantively than the Kuzari. Yes, sir.
The conversation was the idea that say that it's religiously binding and that it has to be acceptable to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But say you brought up it together in Judaism, I mean, we could say Judaism is relying on Jews.
Right.
Somebody who stumbles into Hebrew or that's problematic also in memory, but we also have to categorize for the people who it should be mirrored to signing on, but not, I think someone through the discussion this stuff.
So again, we talked about last year, and I think it's a really interesting point. It is also binding on people who are cultural amnesia. That's what somebody who cannot experience Jewish culture as memory, can only experience it as history because they didn't grow up with it. And so this is a fair point. Whether the longest distinction that we make between a teenage Yeshiva who is bound but others, as opposed to non-Jews who are not bound. But that's the longest distinction we make. And the way we make that is in the same sense, the argument that Kazari would make is in the same sense of saying that an amnesiac is still the person in that same word, they just don't remember it, as opposed to, let's suppose, God forbid, that, because John Doe's there, John Doe lost his memory. Okay? But John Doe is still John, right, is still John Doe, and all the obligations incurring upon him as John Doe, right, his marriage, right, his paternity, all those things are binding on him. It's just that he can't fulfill them because he doesn't know that he's John Doe. Right? As opposed to me. Right? The reason that I'm not married to Jane Doe, It's not because I don't have John Doe's experience. It's because I'm not. I'm not him. Right? So that's the claim that we're making is that Tina Shinishba is an amnesiac. Right? So you still have the identity. You really are Jewish. That is your memory, but you don't have your memory. Right? You lost your memory, which is different than somebody who never had the threat, for whom that's not part of their experience at all.
So that comes off out of Judaism.
So it is, again, it's philosophic framework, that's no different than saying, I don't want to be the person I was yesterday. I want to deny my past. You can't. It's who you are, right? You are the sum of your experiences. Right. So it works. Right. You can succeed in doing it. I think he would argue that these are the Clark Rockefellers of the world. Right. The people who pretend they're people from a small town in Germany, but they pretend that they're a child of the Rockefellers and they live their life that way, but it's a lie.
I guess someone lives, breathes, and does Christianity or Islam, then they're
I think that the idea of saying that universally Jewish, if you don't know Hebrew, you don't know that you're Jewish, and if you don't know that you're Jewish, I don't know, I think it's problematic to do that something to prove the argument. Yeah, okay, look, a genuine Tino Shinishba, right, somebody you're really excited to find out 50 years later.
I think that, look, I should say, if we're doing it from a historical perspective, so the work positions that conversion at work. There are going positions like that with Mary still sites. But...
What do you mean by work?
If you convert it out, you weren't Jewish anymore.
Halakha no longer regards them as Jewish.
So there were positions like that, that conversion out was effective, it feels. How it added up in the scoreboard in heaven, right? Whether it was your last illegal act that's doomed you to hell eternally, but now you're no longer Jewish or not. But right, historically, right, Jacob Katz says the same as peace, that the phrase we all know, Yisrael, right, in the Gemara that's talking about the Jewish people as a whole, talking about the Chatzi Yisrael after the ego, and Rashi, in the aftermath of the First Crusade, applies it to individuals in that theory. Yisrael HaFisha Chatzi Yisrael, the apostasy doesn't work, becomes the dominant position in all of Judaism. But prior to Rashi, there are going positions that don't seem to follow that, and the Erie still cites a position that seems to say that. The people who convert to another dot are treated by us as members of that dot. Yes, Doug.
I have a
question with the
raise of
the
universal conception. One of the elements that goes and aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the basic moral business type of morality that the universe allows me to have that. One thing that there's one point to make is that many philosophers make the move where even in a universal framework, you can derive particular ethics. either obligation to someone's family or obligation to a friend. And the way you can also derive, you know, medical ethics, you know, ethics that apply just for doctors or for any relevant, you know, moral agent with these particular characteristics. So to say that, like, you know, moral judgments apply to all moral agents is sort of, you know, misleading, because you can still derive, you know, universal ethical, you know, obligation among people, you know, relevant, you know, the same relevant characteristics or jobs or perhaps even.
Yeah, no, you can do that.
Yeah.
You're not going to get to something like that, although, you know, the technical philosophical debate, like, you know, whether the only required universalism is something like Aristotle's veil, right, that all people, if it is, that the essential self, not knowing its characteristics, right, if you shifted all the essential self into different circumstances, I'm kind of knocked on that, because people know this is wrong, and really it's Aristotle. The difference is that Aristotle thinks that it's plausible to believe that slavery is the kind of characteristic that is an essential characteristic for some people. That he would say, if that was characteristic of me, I would agree to be a slave, and all think that's impossible. That's the shift that my role can't cancel here, Aristotle can. It's subtle. It's not for the real ignorance of Aristotle. But he'll make a less fancy move. Right? The challenge is that nowadays people take Rawls' position basically, which is that that belief is always going to be an accident, and therefore your obligations can't change based on your belief.
All right, I'm not sure that's what that move is, but all right. I think you can make universalizable ethical judgments that only apply to Jews or people, and I think that most people recognize.
Only apply to Jews?
I'm not sure that's
true,
but
nobody's denying you can't create professional ethics.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
The other point is that, like I said, like the access point that I'm just having an argument is also sort of like a very strong requirement, because that seems to entail that if once I'm not like the smartest guy in the world and I can't drive moral obligations, then I don't have the same moral obligations to other people who are smarter than me.
Yes.
That's also a radical claim that has to be recognized.
Yes, it is a very radical claim, because it seems to suggest that ethical obligation has to be independent of intelligence, among other things.
The opposite. It seems to make the claim that one moral obligation is directly proportional to one's rational ability.
No, because if there are obligations that I can only realize if I'm smart, then they're not ethical at all. Because the definition of ethical obligation is an actual violation.
It's a very radical point.
This is a starting point. The Gemara has a very interesting solution, which is, guess what, we put up these big tablets on the door and everybody could have come and read them. Right, that's the Gemara solution. So then when you recollect that, they can be translated them into big tablets. I think that the Gemara has how do they supposed to know about the Shem Mitzvot?
Oh.
Right, because
they're supposed to read the entire Torah on those...
And figure out exactly what
it is. Just like, I don't think that's like young people in China. It makes sense, it's just...
It's not a great solution. I am very attracted to Cesare's arguments, but not because I think it's formally inarguable. I like the fundamental point. That binding this has to be a function of an entity. And that's your
history.
No. I like... It's a nice way... No, I care. Non-hegemony. But it's not good because I claim it's not binding, but it's true. It's our humility that makes this. That demonstrates our superiority. Right. And the interesting claim is that a demonstration of our superiority does not make it binding. It doesn't go to the best solution that we have to follow.
Okay.
All right, I think I officially surrender on trying to get to the second text at this point. You try to teach everything you have, you know, just sometimes it's just not going to fit. Okay. The counter, there's always trying to set up a dialectic. Because on the one hand, I have these people telling me that Jewish ethics is impossible because once it's Jewish, then it will be derived, or then A, it will apply to Jews differently to other people, so it's not universal in scope. And two, once it's Jewish, it's going to derive from Jewish sources, and Jewish sources require access to a tradition. And therefore, he argues that Jewish ethics is impossible. The counter-objection he takes, and he calls a particular objection, is that Jewish obligation means that you are doing what God wants. And that means, for instance, that means that using standards other than is this what the Torah means is illegitimate. So it's not that it can't be ethics because it's not that it can't be Jewish because it's ethics, but it can't be ethics because it's Jewish. And the notion that you can subject the halakhic system or the Jewish system to independent evaluation by all human beings using tools and universally humanly acceptable, we think, is contradictory to all of the Judaism, which is that we start from a particular text and we take whatever that text is, as binding on us. Okay, so that's the challenge he says, right? Nice ways of framing it. You know, that the reason it has to be universal scope is we don't like saying that things that is, you know, Jewishly right to torture or Frenchly wrong or Frenchly right to torture and Jewishly wrong. Well, I would like to think that there should be rules of war. Those are challenging questions. The response is there are makes to it, as I understand it, it's not a successful or an attempt at a successful form of response. It's an argument that it's a reductio ad absurdum argument. And it's saying that you may be that looks like a really good kasha, but the results of it are impossible. Because that real people are constituted by their experiences and by the obligations that derive from their particular commitment. So the claim, right, so for example, how do you parse the question, should I violate Shabbat and say the like? And what does the question mean for an ethicist? Or should I wear a chatness in order to promote a minority designer? Right, because I think that will contribute to social justice. What you fundamentally do is, claim, if you make the claim that ethics has to be universal, is you make ethics, you either have to claim there is no possibility of obligation outside ethics, and then in fact, right, no one will be ethical, because everyone recognizes obligations that they don't write, that come from the set and values that come from the specific context. Or you make ethics irrelevant, because it doesn't tell you what to do whenever you have any. Right? Ethics becomes what would have happened if we had never lived. Right? What abstract human beings would have done. It's kind of the, I always think this is Horowitz, actually, was the one who formulated this literary class together. The Rambam's notion of divine knowledge is this wild notion that God's knowledge of the future is what would have happened if we didn't have free will. The Mashal was a giant chess computer, but which doesn't know the movie actually made it, doesn't know the movie ought to have made. And it keeps playing the game. As if we had made the wrong move, right? It doesn't work very well. The other thing I tell for those of you who are sci-fi people is the Harry Sheldon Oracle in the Foundation series. Right? You know, if he predicts the future, then, and he programs himself to appear every 50 years or so, right, to tell people, no? No, nobody? All right. Yes,
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
So this question is doing not just the most important person or the community, but it has to be absolute.
Well, but his question is saying that if you want ethics to work, you have to find a way in which ethics can take into account ways of balancing particular obligations. Because
one solution is that ethics is, a particular form of motivation. There are others, but we know what ethics is most important. It can motivate us in ways that others can. But it doesn't need to,
But if any ethical obligation is always the most important, right, then it leaves no space for anything else. Right? If the ethical obligation to always fit, right, to always smile, always make people feel as good about themselves as possible, runs into do I have to say hello to you effusively? I'm a little dying for an answer.
I don't understand why
you
can't
have
different
sorts of value. You can't have different sorts of value. If you want to use ethics as a way of behaving, then it has to recognize the possibility of other sources of value and tell you something about how to deal with conflict.
Sorry,
only
if you have an
overall
insight into ethics, which is everything. You don't need
to. So you just say ethics is just one source among many, and then some meta system needs to integrate them.
Well, there is none. Yeah, they're
intentional. Okay. So what does Jewish ethics mean, though? Because Jewish ethics would just mean that two incommensurable systems then, and everybody works it out for themselves.
Yeah.
Jewish ethics, I think, is a way of trying to develop intuitions of how to solve these problems. And perhaps using concepts from ethical systems or from Jewish systems in order to help solve these problems.
So Jewish ethics is about is Daska about solving conflict between halacha and ethics.
Yeah.
The thought is, I would like to think that halacha includes a good deal of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You can make the claim that when I follow up with Mazikin, I'm just doing divine command, and that it happens to correspond to ethics as coincidence on occasion. But every once in a while, when ethics shows up in a way which conflicts with it, all of a sudden I recognize that I would have done the same thing, and it matters.
The issue of whether halakha incorporates certain things in our ethical notions into the side of halakha is, at least in theory, several from the question of whether ethics and halakha are required.
Yeah, no, you want to claim, that the content of Jewish ethics is the resolution of conflicts between ethics and Judaism.
I wasn't
sure.
Yeah,
that's
one
might
think.
Okay, well, I think he believes the problem is that. Okay, thank you. Well, let's leave your question. Let me go to the other. You want your question, no?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. Okay. Good. I'm gonna unsurrender the second text. Let's see if that does it. Because what I really wanted to get to today is these are useful critiques, and I have to go back and see if I can present or better or right. Because everyone just wants to get Dora to introduce the problem in some ways. Where I want to go is to claim that ethical reasoning is an integral part of halakha. All right, so you can't do halakha properly unless you have access to some source of value external to it as well. I make this argument in various contexts. In the economic case, I make the argument formally by claiming that there are, right, that in any formal system, right, there are irresoluble issues that have to be, right, that you have to resort to a meta standard. But the more powerful way of making this is in the sugya of the Yarigal Yavar, where the Gemara says the only source for knowing that I have to give up my life before killing somebody else is Svara. Right? And I think the Gemara doesn't Daska. Right? Of course we could have found the pasuk, but it doesn't, because I argue this because
if you don't understand that one, then anything we teach you is going to be corrupted anyway, so we'd rather not try. And as you get there, you don't. And then the fun is we take this Jewish Torah principle, and then we say, aha, and like Derech Shabbat, we apply it to Gilui Arayos. That's a really interesting phenomenon. And then there are lots of places where we apply it where it's not rational, right? Like, you know, like three people have given their life other than to one person, right? Where the story is no one near as obvious.
Is that because it's an attempt to keep it
within
the halakhic framework?
I'm not sure. I tend to think that actually these are, you can reframe all those halakhic as moral questions. They show up as purely ethical questions. You can frame it, you can say that, you know, there's a brief spurt of the formalism and everything goes back to formalism, so we have to tame it. There are all sorts of ways to do it. To me, it's just that moment where the Gemara says, well, when I think of, you know, perhaps the central question a religion should answer, which is what you have to give up your life before, right? You know, that's like an important responsibility of religion, is to tell you what is there that is more valuable than life, if anything. And the Gemara just says, you know what? Torah advocates on that one. That's just Torah. Right? You know, if you don't get that Torah, we can't prove it to you. And we're just telling you the story is like that. And either you're a person, either you're the kind of person who we want interpreting Torah, or not. That to me is underlying that Gemara. So I want to integrate that. And the question that then causes lots of trouble for people who live in the Beit Midrash is the lack of verifiability. And, you know, if you're living in the closed system with one source of value, and you're coming from text, so we have some notion of how we get the truth. Right, we have a plausible epistemology. It's not perfect. We understand that text can be multiple things. That people are better. But fundamentally, we all agree on what we're trying to accomplish. And you have a way of pretty much knowing, right, when you're right, which is, this is what the text is. Okay, it gets to be stabilized if you know too much literary theory, right, and literary theory is bad for people who like certainty, but you can do it. Once you start introducing the question, right, that even if you have a really good textual reading, but it might nonetheless not be what Torah wants because it conflicts with some kind of external standard. And the external standards, we have no objective way of deriving, right? It's just intuition, philosophy, not, you know, unlikely to be to be derivable by syllogism. So how do you deal with that? So I want to excuse the way of introducing a text that I find really, really powerful, and I guess it's the base text I use for thinking about the way I want to learn how halacha develop, with caveats. The caveat is that it is in its full form an extraordinarily, you know, there's a very rich Kabbalistic text, and I'm not a Kabbalist in any sense, agnostic in a sense about it, because I don't have any Kabbalistic experience, I don't have any real world reference for the experiential terms that Kabbalah uses, and I'm very uncomfortable using Kabbalah as a purely intellectual system in which I don't know what the words really mean, so I'm just translating the words into vocabulary that matters to me. So the text is stimulating for me. I am very attracted to the model set up, but I can't claim that I am coming from the text, because the text is rooted in epistemology and a vision of reality that I have no way of saying whether I share or not. It just doesn't really, I just don't know what the Kabbalistic experience is. And this is, you know, and certainly the author was heavily rooted in Talmud. This is the introduction to Shiri Das. It's written by, what's the son's name? I always forget. Jesse Filiobach, I think. But it's an introduction to his father. I think I always forget what the son's name is. The problem is in the middle of the talk. And, right, so this is a sort of next logical introduction to Shiri Dot, which is the Talmud Rosh Hashiva's collection of Talmud Rosh Hashiva's Shlugim. it's not always clear to me that it is a perfect reflection of the Father's work, in that the connection between the citations from the Father and the statements by the Son are not immediately felt, and it's not immediately apparent to me always. So I don't want to claim that this is the Shirajat's position. It's the Son's report of the Shirajat's position with frequent quotes that may or may not demonstrate that the authenticity of his method. I should also say that when I taught this here the first time, I had someone come over and did a film and said, wow, no one ever taught me that. And I can't tell you so what the Talmud era is. You know, it purports to be what the Talmud era of Talmud era is. The experience of people when the Talmud does not seem to perfectly conform to it. Okay. So here's what he says. When you have English translations, like my translations, it's going to be tendentious. I'd rather read the Hebrew and then translate it live. And he says that I'll just put in my Tafetra is one of my favorite lines in Samash, where it's from. Where's Tafetra from? Come on, somebody.
No?
You read it? Should I read it some weeks ago? Alright, well, I guess I'm glad I had the occasion to put a funny law on Rodi Hashem. Then it's Sharin Nibuba Baal, it's a Sephra Loidani, Karim Pashavi. Pretty short, then we go to Kachi and say, and look at the Marilan. I do encourage you all to try and get enough of what they've made, but at the very least, you should try and do it. I totally encourage you to do something in your life. Just read through all synopsis as well as the good assumption there. I did it on Friday night, I think. It's not 4 years in college. I just read synopsis on Friday night. So I think it's not such a long book. Okay. So, Yom Yisrael Gat Tatsuk Fet. I saw Moon Moon Roy Hashem. It's a Fet Rally Yidumi, Berlin Pashuvi, and Yidin Yiduva Dal Vachreli Yidu Halachi. So this is something important to me for two reasons. A, from a pharaonic perspective, when people like to claim, that in the time of the temple, all there were priests. And this whole notion of rabbis and rabbinic Jews and Torah scholars and all that is a much later invention. So we just look at the pasuk and say, gee, Kohanim. Okay, those are priests. Nevi'im, those are prophets. Ro'im, those are political leaders. Who are the Tosfot after that?
No,
there are four types of religious leadership at the end of the first temple. Each of them has their own religious laws, and it seems to be pretty clear that when you got rid of political leaders, priests and prophets, that you got less our teachers. It means that there's a class of teachers, there's a class of teachers of Torah, right?
And
no, as a whole, there's definitely called Yom Tovkei Torah. Yes, but Bazi Devarim tells you that perhaps an ideal system, right, priests serve that function. But by the end of Vayit Rishon, there was a separate class of Torah scholars. So it's not like rabbis grew up out of nowhere. And by Rishon, you already have a class of Torah scholars. That's right, that would be nice. Most people claim that the whole notion of law, of Torah, right, of Torah scholars and all that is an exilic phenomenon.
So they created their own position. Once we got together to really acquire and we went and stuff,
they don't finish them, which is still possible for them.
Maybe, but then, you know, I don't
know. Authority is, I mean, what we don't understand is authority can't. It's probably not what we have in there, so you can't really...
I don't want rabbinic authority. I want
rabbinic culture.
I want people to study Torah and transmit it.
I don't think anyone has a problem with people saying they were learners and they're a bunch of people in the community. But
they were recognized as having formal authority independent of priests? This is a class of religious functionaries?
You know what their authority was.
I don't know what it was. I just know that they're...
Some guy who played the knowledge one that possibly cannot be one over this guy. You know, I told you, when he was talking about he had this much stuff on not.
That I don't know.
But they reported that the human dimension, okay. The of the of course, is having established the class, and you discover that there's a right that they can be critiqued, because if they lose track of God. But even though they still have the Torah, and that's here. The second thing, so these are people who genuinely have the Torah, and it's just they don't know God, so it gets corrupted. So I like that something both ways, because if you historically establish the rabbi, the second one establishes the rabbi can be corrupted.
It's also if you want to challenge academic
For heaven's sake, so we get into a silly circuit again. I'll talk about this next Wednesday, where you have your historical theory and you assume that all the evidence against it is ready to add later. Right, so you get through it, really, the thing, all the paper you have is really about the AQ. There's lots of stuff in here, it isn't about the AQ, that's all put in later. No, I think there's a level of plausibility. And at some point, if you have to, if your theory is supposedly based on, if your theory is independent based, that's one thing, but if your theory is based on the text, and when we say, oh, there's lots of evidence in the text that contradicts it, your solution is all that evidence about it later, you understand that you're making a faith claim, you're not making an academic claim. Unless you can show that the material contradicts something else in the text, so explicitly, it is obviously, I'll talk about it Wednesday night. I don't think you have to reject that method per se to acknowledge that sometimes it's silly. I'm going to talk about this at length Wednesday night. So the Tosefta, right? Shani and Derek Henry have been Tosefta. So the Derek Henry of the Tosefta, I think, without the negative connotation of who don't know me. Divided into three ways. Although we'll see that his three ways don't line up so well with the three ways he actually said that. So we'll get to Derech HaPilkul, Derech HaHigayon HaMishpati, and Derech HaHavanah HaTorani. Okay, Derech HaHavanah HaTorani is not actually the good way, that's the funny thing, because Derech HaHavanah HaTorani turns out just to be some kind of hodgepodge of the other two. And he rejects that, and what he really wants is the fourth way. And just the classifications got messed up. So the first method is the Balei HaPilpul. And I hear that you should all be aware that Pilpul is not a term with a single meaning historically. Historical Pilpul, the academic claim that historical Pilpul is a particular method of teaching in which you would walk into class. You assign the text, you walk into class, the students would ask all the questions they could, and the job of the teacher was then to give a lecture which answered all the questions on the basis of a single theme. Right, and so a pilpul was a piece of performance art. It's fun to try. It's very fun to try. And the truth is, if you set up the text properly, then you know what the questions will be, and if you're a good enough lecturer, you can say, right, you can pick out the questions you already knew would be asked, and make all the other ones tangential. But it's a cool piece of performance art. It's much better, of course, if you just walk in and say, ask me any questions anywhere in Torah. And I will show you the interconnectedness of all things. That's also how you understand what this week's parsha has to do with the parsha. I was can't wait to be able to do that. That's a fantasy. Pilpul, as we know it nowadays, tends to refer to what Dr. Zolotich called the giant clockwork theory of the Talmud, right? Which the Talmud is one, the vision of the metaphor of the Talmud is a giant Rube Goldberg machine, and we have to just figure out if you move the little man, right, of the parachute, right, so that you knock him off his perch, so he lands on the leather, so that releases the marble,
right? And the job of the filter list is to be able to figure out all the ramifications of moving the one hand of the car shoot and the filter machine. That's the software, that's the software. There's lots of levers and things like that, and everything sticks. It's really cool. You know, that's what we did. We saw a little bit in the sound filter, right, going through that kind of thinking, and it's a really cool, that's what I call hedge fund. It's a really cool mode of thinking, which regrettably is underappreciated. The Jeff Schneider is the classic work that puts that together. But tiltful in tiltful often just means whatever the intellectually coolest way of learning is right now. Right? It's basically what tiltful just means straight hot peppers, right? It means really sharp. So you need to be careful that what tiltful means in this text is risk. Tiltful refers to, right, because risk is a method that is opposed to intellectual method of the time that he's writing, and he's entering. Here's what he says, right? Valiat tiltful reluvier gishus, ke asorah dosha ilamala nifeshel ha'adam, the filuki halakta dakim, will be frate adivin ha'nizgabim, the yashuv in the gear of the tefel and the shield of the sun, ke asorah shamayimiti, the mikorah lamala batoish. Okay, so the parts that he just said. What he says is that the briskers look at Torah and they say, guess what? Torah has tons and tons of details. Torah, this is the presumption that Torah, whether it is accurate or not my issue. Their position is that Torah mandates at such a level of detail that there cannot be any humanly accessible rational justification for the mandate. Okay, right. If you were engaged in trying to achieve some rational purpose, then you would tell people to wash their hands before bread. You wouldn't tell them to wash their hands, right, to wash their hands. Right on this hand and right on that hand, make sure that, right, make sure that you have X amount of water first, right, make sure the water doesn't drip on it, right? You just don't do that, right? What you want is people to have clean hands. Right, every level of the law, down to, right, not just the post milk diam, but the begin, the shallows, all of them are defined with this incredible fine tooth precision. Right, level detail. There are many other explanations to this phenomenon. And the Spanish Greek people have a really interesting claim that the reason for it is to make sure that people don't be rabbis. And if you define the law in great detail, then that's right. It's really interesting. Of course, that hasn't worked very well because of the assumption that all the details are that specific. That means we have to ask others every time a new case comes up because there has to be a predefined law. But that was the kind of reason we'll make that. I'm blaming him. Sorry. It's really interesting. It's a good person. He was a senior. He has this big claim, he quotes the road rather ironically, to support it, which I think is one of the great disputes of the quote of all time. But in the theory is really interesting, even though it's exactly opposed to what the road mentioned in the quote you say. The Briskers, as Sir Bluff understands them, say, well, look, all these halakhahs, no humanly acceptable rational purpose could explain it. So these demonstrate that practical reason is not a valid standard for judging halakhic ideas. And since there's no practical reason, that could justify this level of detail, it means that the whole exercise of the Sanctuary has to be liberated from policy constraints. And that's what generates a notion that the whole goal is to come up with rational distinctions, right, rational principles that generate these outcomes. That are not practical rational outcomes. They're just between practical and abstract reasons. And so Brisk is the client, right, the client that I can come up with some kind of formulation that will adequately describe and possibly even occasionally predict, right, what the law will be in a whole set of details,
whether or not we can see the difference of that distinction. All we do is come up with an abstraction. Right? If it turns out, let's say that the Halakha is that all, that if a red cow damages, it pays 100%. But if a green cow damages, it pays 90%. If a blue cow damages, it pays 80%. Even though, there's no reason to distinguish between red, green, and blue cows. And we're not going to pretend that we have red cows are more aggressive or anything like that. It doesn't matter. As long as we can say there's a red cow, a green cow, a blue cow, we have a rule now and explain this whole set of details, we're fine. Okay, that's his vision of Brisk, and he sees Brisk. And it's an interesting understanding of this. It is fundamentally rooted in a rejection of any idea that halakha can be explained pragmatically or practically. Right? Well, the Derech HaLimud is predicated on the claim that halakha has no rationally accessible purpose. No. It just has no purpose. It doesn't matter to them, right? Because it might be that some of these things make people be less likely to make people follow rules.
No, a lot of that. We assume that halakha follows rules.
We assume that our job is to understand the rules. Like we're setting the mind of God.
We're really assuming that it's all rational.
Halakha is rational in the sense that in the... Right, halakha is coherent. Halakha is coherent. Right, and it does... And it is formally logical. Halakha is formal. That's what I said. It doesn't have to reason the rules, right? For, you know, the rules, it doesn't become right from the rules to Midrash Halakha is a set of rules also. It doesn't have to conform to what we call logic. It has to conform to a set of formal principles. Yes?
Are you just meaning in the
test
of coherence? Is that really all it is?
No, there's only coherence
there. There's a coherence
there.
But the certain
premises
cannot be derived. Or any of the rules you're giving
us
can't be practically...
You can never test it by the way it's working in the real world. You can never ask what is this trying to accomplish? Those are all invalid questions. What can it accomplish is an invalid question, because if you care about accomplishments, you would have stopped before you got
there. What are the valid questions?
The valid questions are, what is the set of abstractions that can generate the set of details?
Which is already given.
So the set of details are given, yes. The Brisk is not an attempt. If you understand, the Brisk is not an attempt
of deriving more.
Of deriving more holocaust. Right? It's truly, right? And this is... part of why it's an accurate description of why Brisk is not useful for stuff. Because it's not interested. Brisk is a descriptive of archaeological endeavor. Given this thing.
Okay, yes.
But the Trinity is just looking a lot better than a bunch of independent rules.
Yeah.
By law, you don't have to assume that there are people who are independent rules or following their lives and following their plan.
We
look at this and we say, oh, the rules here are on the contrary.
He could.
So we are
assuming
something that I understand
more. They're making an argument, right? Their argument is, you look at this, it's not explicable on a policy level, right? So we have to approach it in a proper fashion.
It's not completely on its own terms. There's an assumption they're bringing to the table.
Which is?
The and the
yeah, they are assuming coherence because they have a theological position. It comes from the mind of God. Yeah, right. It's nothing. Yeah, you always have to have premises, right? They're not
saying.
No, you could do that, right? But that way, it's truly arbitrary. But that you haven't they kind of thought what Talmud Torah is. Yeah, you could do that. That wouldn't find itself.
They're
not going to have it.
They're saying that there's nothing being brought to the table and it's only
the No, I don't think they're not saying that. I think I agree. They're coming to the table. They're bringing the assumption of coherence to the table. Okay. Now, he says the second approach, which he calls, he says Baram, however, Kishin Poneh Balicha Fatora, Rolim Anan, Ki Acharek Dushatav Ram Nusa, Vinayim Iker Yanin Al Yisodot Hamit Amatinim Losecha Hashimushi. It says, if you look at halakha, it's an awful coincidence that the broad categories of halakha are roughly the same as you would use in terms of practical reason. Right, so if you look at them, you say, well, look, you know, it looks like a lot. You have to know, right, they parallel issues with so-called nefesh adam, right, they parallel right, human development, and so faith, criminal love, and social order, and the chloring is far, right, economic, right, economic rules, the to nature, the nature of creation and people. So right, this is just, his argument is this is just too much to be coincidence. Right? The Briskers claim that the level of detail is too great, but the level of detail, they have a powerful argument, that halakha can't be judged by policy considerations. But at the level of principle, the level of categories, so many of the categories are exactly the same as the categories any legal system would have to have. It has to define money, it has to define property ownership, and it has to define fraud, it has to define power, right? And then it has to do all those things.
This is the thing that it answered all the questions that we wanted to answer, or is he saying it answers satisfiably?
You're not saying it answers satisfiably. You're saying that you map halakha on other legal systems, and you discover, right, this is his vision. Right,
this is the thing, it's a sufficient system.
Yeah, it looks just like, the only difference is, right, again, this is his vision, it's acting on not my issue. The only difference really is the level of detail. So fundamentally, if you were taking out the abstractions, what are the categories of law, how often would be no different than any other system? Yes, sir.
It also covers all kinds of stuff that other legal systems have zero interest in, like what the fruit of a beautiful tree is, and, you know,
tell us if
he covers all these aspects of ritual law, which most legal systems have no interest in.
So that's an interesting question about how he does this. I think he sees a lot of ritual laws addressing psychological issues and self-development issues just on more detail than most systems would have. I don't think so, but I don't need to push it. At the very least, right, there are many areas of halakha. Right, there are many areas, right, we can make it, at least there are many areas of halakha that map very well on the secular law. And he thinks that the claim that that's coincidence is just not plausible. It's just a cosmic joke that God set up in that, you know, totally arbitrary, purposeless. The right system is no human acceptable legal system would be exactly like the others. And you could have fun. You could claim that really it's not coincidence, all the others developed out of halakha. Right? But he doesn't want to make that claim. But he even goes further. Right? And this is after the three dots. He says, that will take the skillful hatsura. Somebody who engages in intellectual study without evaluating it by the standard of practical reason, humanly acceptable rationality. If you engage in Torah as an entirely autonomous, self-contained system, you will end up coming up with descriptions of halakha that generate results that contradict the broad purposes. You will end up producing an economic system that can't regulate, right, that can't regulate money. Right, and a political system that can't prevent chaos. And if you say, well, look, the goals of political systems are to prevent chaos, and halakha looks like a political system, but oops, well, we understand halakha, it works out that all we have is chaos. Right, but that is saying it must be wrong. Yes,
if I understand you correctly, you're suggesting that Barakat Kopal does not recognize an independent aspect of the halakha, and that Barakat again is true.
Well, I don't want to use load the word ethic.
Sorry, or as an independent source of value.
As an independent source of value, yes. Yes. That's the connection between the good. So there are times when the results of simple are just contradicted by reality. Sometimes they say things that are practically absurd. They contradict reality, and sometimes they say things that are meaningless. And they make distinctions without a difference. If you look at it and you say, well, that makes no difference. Now, again, in the British universe, he sets it up, we just say, tough. Right? So it matters to God what color the cow is, even though we can't figure out why. But he says that it seems to him that, right, that this is the right, that the true halacha has to make sense in accordance to practical reason, meaning that A, its outcomes have to be, right, have to achieve the broad purposes of law, and B, its distinctions have to be practically meaningful. Yes, sir. Okay. And it says, now then he makes a really interesting psychological claim. He says, we lost those, and without evaluating your pilpul on the basis of practical reason, it's impossible for a chacham who is teaching so he says that if in fact what you are doing, what you are being, is a human being who is engaged in studying God's mind directly, and there is no correspondence whatever between your mind and God's mind, right? If he's playing out, he's saying a Brisker is a Rambam who actually believes his own philosophic position. Right? I wrote a paper that I still sort of have attractions to, even though I have been more persuaded of the validity of Kaufman readings lately. But we're trying to deal with the classic contradiction of Rambam and the Mura, where in one place he says that there is no correspondence whatever between God's knowledge and our knowledge. The two terms are said between Suska, more than complete homonymes, right? And even, so that's what they say, and you can't even say that God's knowledge, because the knowledge is said of God primarily and us secondarily. Because there is no connection whatsoever between us and God. And when the same term is used about God and us, you're not thinking any way that there's any etymological connection. And it's true, it says that God, it says that with Inida, and it says that Damida, well, it's a good example, right? Because Damida is carnal. Right? So the term Yidya has no connection whatsoever. It could just as well have said that we know and God blitz, or God blitz and we know, right? Because the word knowledge used about both of us is a confusion. Two chapters later, Rambam explains that God's knowledge is said of God primarily and not secondarily. And he gives a metaphor, and in the first chapter, I think it's 320, he tells it explicitly, and no metaphor could possibly bridge the gap, and then two chapters later, he gives you a metaphor, which is the potter knows his pot directly as opposed to the purchaser. So in my story, I wrote a paper, or second in which I argued that the point is that if the Rambam philosophy were true, and then Ram's life is meaningless. Because Ram's life is about talking or about describing God in your mind, that's what he does. And the logical consequence of his argument is that you cannot describe God in your mind. That's impossible. Henry Murray Park. So if you take that, the logical consequence of being around that way, this whole sentence position of Ram must be agnostic, because the word is can't be said about God in the same way it's said human beings, so therefore you ask the question, is God? The answer has to be, I don't know. Right? So you can't say it, right? I'm not sure for the argument works, but it's not a bad argument. The Rabbah has a devastating response to it, I think. You can't claim simultaneously that God does not have, knowledge and that God is not ignorant. Right, this knowledge and ignorance are antonyms. So you have to choose. And to say that God is ignorant is worse than saying that God is ignorant of knowledge from his perspective. And Rambam claims that you can avoid the law of the middle. Right? You can say that something is that God is simultaneously right, not knowledgeable and not knowledgeable. I think the robot critique is devastating, but that's not the position that we need to address here. So, I think that
I think that people psychologically will not take positions that will not take accept the consequences of positions if the consequence of that position is that their life is that they can't do the thing they think is most important. So what Telger is arguing is that if the Briskers really thought about what they were saying, what they would say is, I am trying to study God's knowledge, which I believe is entirely different than my knowledge, through my mind. How can I ever know that I have God's mind right? That it feels good to me, intellectually, is not right at all. Maybe God loves contradiction. Right? Maybe God likes saying 2 plus 3 equals 5, which is not a logical problem. Maybe God likes saying A and not A, yay. Right? Maybe God doesn't right. So therefore he says that if the Brisker you were being fully consistent, he would live in eternal agony of never knowing that anything you said was true. Whereas, if you take the position that there is some humanly acceptable form of knowledge which you can use to test your abstraction, then you can have some element of certainty. Right? So he sees that as he thinks that Briskers should live in continual uncertainty, and they shouldn't want that, and therefore Briskers should concede the value of acknowledging that Torah has pragmatic purpose. Now the Briskers don't get acknowledged like that by that any more than Rambam is, but he thinks they ought to be. Yes, sir. Well, now the question is, but should you live in doubt anyway?
Right.
Right, so have you solved the problem at all? Okay, good question. Right, we'll talk about whether you succeed or not. Right, that's the kind of the question at the end is whether you succeed or not. But that's his critique. Right, his critique of Brisk is that it explains, ironically, is that it explains details well, but not broad principles, and that it can't generate certainty. Ironically, again, because it doesn't admit external sources of validation.
Many Briskers actually care about whether there's certain definite or right, and actually not
possibility. You might argue, if you're having fun, you might argue that the Lichtenstein is a response to this critique. But before Lichtenstein, Briskers were about truth, right, and demonstration and all that. Lichtenstein is an incredible fetish that we've given up on that, and our business might go one step further. I think it's an interesting argument to make if we're writing a philosophy paper that the Gush Derech is an outgrowth of this critique. I don't think it would be true, but I think it would be an interesting argument to make. I think it's generated by entirely different practice. Okay. Therefore he says, even though this method is fun, it doesn't reach truth. I think it's Torah Chaim and not Torah Demet. Which I'm just using your listening term, but it's not going to. Okay, now he says, there are people who use legal reasoning, choose the opposite approach. I have no idea who he is talking about when he says this. I don't know. Mishpat Ivri is a really fairly recent phenomenon. He would not have known about the Mishpat Ivri movement. So I have no idea. I have no idea what move he's talking about. There was a group of Zionist thinkers, religious Zionist thinkers, who worked very hard to try and translate halacha into useful modern categories. Whether he would have been familiar with people like Eliezer Berkowitz, I suppose possibly Rav Amiel, others of the important religious Zionist thinkers of around the turn of the century. I'm sorry, around the mid century. I don't know.
Could you just talk about posting? I don't know.
I tell you off the right. He claims that there's an exactly approach. People who see halacha only as politics. Right? He claims that they succeeded. Please look at the Torah of the Torah. They have the cancer. They succeeded this way in explaining many sections of the Torah. The closest approach to what he's talking about is Rambam. No, I think that's when they thought they explained lots of stories successfully. I don't think it is. I don't think so. The other thing I think it was random. I don't know, you know, who learned like that. I don't know anything. I don't know, you know, someone could unearth who his reference word is by going through other writings there as well and seeing if he refers to this or other contemporary terms. I have no historical context. So these are right, but these are what we would call nowadays Mishpati three people. So there's rational policy explanations for every aspect of halacha. He says, you know what, they make a lot of Torah work, but he says, Lam, Misha ta'am me'etachayim, v'zachar l'argishek d'shan t'ra v'erudata, yedah v'yakir, kilimun ha'tara v'yashut u'perut kazu, sholeh l'kot ha'chayim, chayeh lam sh'yesh b'tzartena t'sha, t'rat ha'chayim, mashchit t'arevuta. Because first of all, this is experientially unsatisfying. Right, if you learn halacha, the only purpose of halacha is practical, is practical purpose, is practical results, then halacha sounds like an analytical system. And who cares if it's halacha, that's his argument. And you can't really enjoy learning that way. That's basically his bottom line. You can't really enjoy learning that way. Yes,
sir. I think one of the things he's noting is that halacha is being finished by a complete legal system. It's pretty much the only legal system that requires learning with itself, which not.
Yes, that is true. This argument only assumes that learning is a value, right? You know, if you just reduce the law to the administrative law, right? And so it assumes that again, the way the Rambam would critique this, he believes by saying, sure, learning law is boring, but learning philosophy is interesting, right? And what's the problem, right? There is no law, there is philosophy, and the law is just something you have to know what to do. Okay, but he's not. He's a Rosh Yeshiva. So he assumes that learning, right, so his critiques in both cases, the critique of the first one is that in order to be satisfied learning, you have to have some belief that you come out with truth, and the second one is in order to be satisfied learning, you have to have fun. And he thinks the briskers are always, right, can never know that they're true, and the Mishkali free people will never have fun. And then he ends up saying, well, guess what? That also, they can't explain the details. The details don't have a rational policy reason. So we have to critique of both the, right, he thinks that the abstractionists don't get the principles right, and that the pragmatists don't get the details right. It's very nice, ironic. Okay, then he comes out again, the Derech HaShlishi is just boring, and it tries to compromise and fail. It turns out none of these three methods look to achieve truth. So now we get to tell the Derech, which does. So we're on the underlying section now.
Is this the fourth?
I'm sorry, the categorization. The third one is just, again, if we were an academic, we would show that clearly this is written by different authors because originally someone was supposed to do those three, right, those three, and someone chipped it. Because it's really badly structured, and no other possible explanation. All right. So here's the theory. Right, everything that exists in our world, this is the Kabbalistic position, which is that the best metaphor I can give you is that the world is a series of an infinite series of universes, but there is a one-to-one correspondence between each point in every universe and a single point in every other universe. Okay, the points can be different sizes, they can be different material, whatever it may be, but basically the infinite series of the universe is a series of infinite lines. And every space in the universe is occupied by a point through which one and only one line passes. Yes, ma'am.
What is the name of this universe?
It's Kabbalistic, and the interstellar universe is basically goes from God to physical reality.
Oh.
Right, it's right. That there's a right. Right again. Right. That's his vision. So every unit, right. So every
every point in every universe has a one-to-one correspondence with a point in every other universe. Okay, building off that, he says, right, that same verse says, but just like there is nothing physical that does not have a metaphysical root, there's also nothing in the metaphysical world that doesn't have a physical ramification. So we end up learning, every concept, every understanding we have of the straightforward matters in our world, everything we know about, right, everything we know about our reality,
everything that we learn about the world is also knowledge about God. Everything we learn about God is also knowledge about the world because there is a one-to-one correspondence. Okay, so the move you're going to make, obviously, is that the Mishpat Ivri people are learning about the world. But therefore, right, therefore some of that has to come, right, that has to apply to knowledge of God directly, and the Brishpas are learning God directly, but some of it has to relate to the world. Right, and any system which is only true up here but not true down here is false. Any system which is only true down here and not true up there is false. Because truth is correspondence between these two forms of knowledge.
How is this distinct from the third?
One more move.
Okay.
I know the third move, you haven't explained any details, it's not there, but you've got one more move which might succeed in distinguishing anybody who never does that. Yes, that way.
They correspond one-to-one. Right. The recipe is that there, in whatever way that universe differs from ours, that it then degenerates, you can't say that it has no, there's no connection. You can't make the wrong claim that there's no, right, the
but
terms of this.
So
you can do primary versus secondary, or you can do higher versus lower, whatever axis you want. Doesn't matter. Big axis. As long as there's some way of rejecting our own position that a term used about something in that role, there's no application. I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
Right? For me, the way to frame it formally is this is a rejection of the Rambam. Right, and a claim that you're not allowed to say, it's wrong ever to say that there are things which are true in the one realm that have no application in the other. Okay, that's all.
The nature of the connection is Kabbalistic. Okay. So therefore, he's now justified his test, his evaluation of one by the other. And it's not that you're judging Torah by politics. What you're doing is checking your understanding of Torah is true, because your understanding of Torah has to be true in both realms. But then he has one more move. He says, "Nishmat Adam." Here's the next part, right? Nishmat Adam, mafila b'kirba kol yanei habriya. The soul of the human being includes within it all aspects of creation. And the human being the human soul is a microcosm. It's a really small universe. And that's a very standard Jewish position, but certainly a very common Kabbalistic position. The Lachain, he terminal to Machshavto Mekuvenet Ela Metziyut HaEnokit, he ha Mekuvenet Metziyut HaTorah. Therefore, the authentic self, which is in tune with one's true reality, is also identical with Torah, and also identical with the entire universe. Okay, and I set up a three-way one-to-one
one-to-one correspondence. The Torah is the blueprint of the world. That's ultimately the Torah is the highest world and physical reality is the lowest world. And of course, the deepest world actually is Bar Alma, which means that God extended every point in Torah, right, until it became this world. And the human being
is also a threat, is also a microcosmos. So the human being, is a one-to-one correspondence of the world. The world is a one-to-one correspondence of Torah. Therefore, the human being is a one-to-one correspondence of Torah. It's following. The human being corresponds to the world. The human being is a one katan. And the world corresponds to Torah. Right? So A equals B, B equals C, A equals C. Therefore, the human soul corresponds to Torah. Everything in Torah has to find a place in your soul. Everything in your soul has to find a place in Torah. If there's something in your soul that does not resonate with Torah, then you're missing something in Torah. You're missing something in Torah. There's something in Torah that doesn't resonate with your soul. Then you're unaware of some aspect of yourself. That's his assertion. Okay. So the Shmat is done. The Chilavik Yerbal Kol Yenei Habriya. The Lachayin Iker Mahutzol Machshisol Mesudenetu Amisiyutzol 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 Amisiyutzol. Right, so your authentic self is going to correspond with Torah. Ki Adam, Shemachil B'Kirbo Kol Yenei Habriya, Yachol Limtzoa Tamitas Das Torah Rak Bo Be'Atzmo. Right, so he says ultimately, you have to, right, the truth of Torah has to be found within you. Right, if something were true Torah, it would have to have a place within you. And if you finish reading Torah and you say, that's interesting, but it has no connection to me, then it must not, right, if you're right, then it's not there. However, you're wrong.
The problem is that people often have false consciousness. And so they don't understand their true self, and so they see a lack of correspondence, and the lack of correspondence is not a flaw in the Torah, but a flaw in their self-knowledge. This to me is the key educational, self-educational one. What he says is that on the one hand, I mean, he doesn't play the argument in full, so I'm going to play what I think is a reasonable extension of his argument, but he does not make it as broadly as I make it, and you can go back and check with him. So this is the extension of there. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the soul, the Torah, and the world. The way in which one evaluates the truth of one's knowledge in any of these three things, Torah, self, and the world, is by how well it corresponds to the other. And so knowledge that there is, you check, do I know myself well? Well, do I find myself in Torah? And what it means to find yourself in the world, it's a very intense attempt to avoid that question. My knowledge, this is what I think the text means. Is it true? Well, does it correspond to my knowledge of the world? And does it correspond to my knowledge of myself? And that's his methodology. His epistemology of Torah, the way in which you check whether what you're doing is authentic Torah or not, is, are you emerging with Torah which is true to the text, which is true to reality, which is true external reality, and which is true your sense itself. Yeah, so it's circular, actually, right? Yeah. It's circular. And all, but it's reflecting the sense that, right, how do you check your knowledge of the world, but those are not. Yes. Okay, and then he says, the problem with this is that, fundamentally, he doesn't address, after the opening question, he doesn't address so much the question of the world. Like, he doesn't address the clash between science and tradition and visual, but those useful, the thinking of that. What he says here, which is he says that the problem is that if we use this method, now on the one hand it's a method of verification, on the other hand it's a method that can lead to massive distortion. Because if you have a, if you, right, so these metaphors, so you have to, the correspondence will only be apparent if you're functioning at the same level. And at least you can see the connection. But if your knowledge of Torah is massive,
and knowledge of self is minimal. Then you're going to end up saying, all this Torah must be wrong, because I can't find any reflection of it in the self. Or you'll end up distorting Torah in order to match your, say, well, you know, that understanding of Torah, you know, leads to this result, but it doesn't seem to match my understanding, which is that the purpose of life is pleasure, or it may be. So, right, I have to come with any Torah that matches my understanding of myself, because I am a being created, right, to be pleasure. So, he argues as a learning methodology, what it has to do is continually evaluate whether it conforms to whether one's interpretation of Torah conforms to reality and resonates psychologically. But the learning methodology comes with an additional spiritual responsibility, which is you have to be careful that you grow personally and you grow in Torah at the same rate. And that you be conscious of gaps between the depth of your Torah knowledge and the depth of your self-knowledge, so that you can be aware that the test is invalid in that particular area. For example, you know, I think, let's say, unmarried people should not necessarily test the truth of their Torah by whether it corresponds to their sense of self as a sexual being. Right? Because the knowledge of yourself, right, is not going to be the same. People without children should not evaluate their understanding, their understanding of the without aim, whether it corresponds fully to their own experience, because they're not right. So there are parts of their self they don't know what they don't know what they function like. Right? But all areas, and you have to be aware that sometimes you gain one kind of knowledge at the expense of another. And some kind of knowledge you can never have. Right, sometimes you have to choose. Like, you know, for example, you cannot have, you know, it's an argument I make all the other contexts, right? You cannot both have the experience of a variety of sexual partners and of lifetime monogamy. Right, those are mutually incompatible experiences, and you have to recognize that it's not that the choice of lifetime monogamy is a choice to surrender experience. It's a choice to pick one type of experience over another. Right, and experience is unusually exclusive. And so therefore there will never be any a situation in which you can be confident that you are capable of evaluating all aspects of Torah. Yes, Mark? Okay, so I want to say that, you know, this is a programmatic text for me, in the sense that it's a text that I use to evaluate myself, not often with happy results. But that I feel that is a really useful principle both for learning, right, that the best learning is learning that corresponds to an idea as to your knowledge of the world. You say, wow, now that I understood this about Torah, now I understand more about the world, not necessarily in a crude scientific sense. Like, I just, you know, not that I understand the specifics of, but I understand how society functions, I understand, you know, something about the way, right, something about the order of nature, something like, right, things like that. At least those are the things that I care about. And also that it helps you, right, that it helps you say, well, you know, I didn't understand that about myself before, but now that I have a formulation of this halacha, I can look at it and say, oh, and that explains, right, that explains something about my own behavior that I've never gotten before. And so I care, you know, that's what I point out. When you have a realization of self-knowledge, then the instinctive question should be, you know, all of a sudden you're like, oh, now I just can't believe who I am. You know, the first question you ask is, and how does that change my understanding of Torah? And is it compatible? And if the way I understand myself all of a sudden throws, let's say, the way I understand myself as a parent all of a sudden throws all the people's kibbutz out of aim, as I was talking out of kilter, and say, well, if they don't kibbutz out of aim, my understanding doesn't work at all. For me, as I understand myself now, then something's wrong. And you can either question the apparent insight, or you need to say, well, I need to go back and learn this with Kibbutz Avayim differently, because it's just not true. Right? I must have misevolved it, you know, so those are, you know, certainly in the context of the comment, one of the things I understand myself as is, you know, I think I'm a journalist. Even though I don't engage it professionally, but it's still, you know, still part of my identity, I think, is, you know, which is born largely in college. And that affects how I understand how the questions are.
At the same time, you know, the kind of planet, also, and I have to figure out how all that, and I also have to ask the question about whether I think a society will work that way. Do I think people can live that way? Do I think people will work that way? Do I think it's true that I become a better or worse person if I speak X or Y? All those are legitimate, not only legitimate, but necessary questions, according to Thread, according to the law, in order to evaluate the world. Yes.
So self-knowledge and an understanding of commercial stuff in a certain area, and then there's a corresponding theory that would about what do you, what do I do?
Well, I think you lose intention until you figure out which one.
Yeah, I mean, part of the question is a little bit of a second. It just seems to suggest that the corresponding solves the kind of uncertainty.
It solves one formal problem with certainty, at the expense of setting up a multi-concept, which is always much more complex and given, and so there's different kinds of uncertainty. I don't know if it solves a certainty problem at all. If he sets it up, I'm not sure it solves it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it does in some ways, like it prevents grievous error. That's what most multi-concepts do, is they prevent grievous error. He's less likely to make grievous error if you apply this process.
Yeah, I just don't have any sense of direction. Like, I don't see where I would, like, what I would do if I have a problem in self-knowledge. Like, what would I do in my case? What are the limits of changing when you find your problem? What are the limits of understanding?
Oh, they go back to integrity. Our rule. Most understanding of Torah is that it has to be something that you genuinely believe is understanding of Torah. Yes,
Michael. So, using the second method of understanding is really important. So, what is the proper method to study everything according to how it works in society and then try to figure everything out?
No, he also took a self to explain the details. Second method, right? But, he sets the Brisker point that there's no humanly rationally accessible reason for the level of detail in all of them. And whether you find it a compelling claim or not is an issue, but he accepts it.
That's the only thing that's... Okay,
Jeff, you're
interested. I want to get back to the obvious thing for a second. I think when you don't necessarily either understand or accept, I don't understand it, frankly. Is the Kabbalistic claim on which he's basing this? I think it's hard to see this. But that's the problem. He sees his correspondence model as real, right? And he says, and if there is a disjunction, you are genuinely misunderstanding something, and that's true because metaphysically, this is how the world works. That there actually is direct correspondence between the Torah and my soul and the world, and as a consequence, any disjunction I see is a false consciousness, and I have to work to fix that. But when you take that away, or just sort of, or even like turn it into a metaphor instead of making it a real metaphysical claim, I'm not so sure how useful this is anything beyond sort of, well, it would be great if you make these things, why not? But like what God was saying, when you see the conflict between yourself and the Torah, you know, for a book, that's actually impossible. It cannot be that something I know about myself is different than something I know about the Torah. I must misunderstand something. But without that, I mean, if you don't have that basic catalytic presupposition, I think it kind of falls apart and they can be all, well, wouldn't it be nice if these things could correspond?
I don't need Kabbalah to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I can get there by saying that of course the world is in the mind of God. And of course, right, how else would the world come into being if it weren't, right? And of course it's in the mind of God, that's by definition. And the, I'm arguing with the Rambam too, so you want to know God, study physics and metaphysics, so I thought about the straight Rambam argument there, and then it seems to me a very plausible Jewish position to take
that being a cell in the Lakim, right, means that somehow within you there should be,
that's a much looser claim than saying there's a one-to-one correspondence.
If I made that same argument logistically, I could make a different argument. I could claim that God expressed part of his mind and Sarah and part of his mind in the world, and truth emerges from a dialectical tension between them. If I were a Rose student, or a dialectical tension, the three aspects of divinity, but that sounds awfully Christian. So I don't want to do it. So, yeah, that helps. I don't have a problem with an argument like that. That conforms to my own belief structures really well. Without making any capitalistic commitments, I can't bind you to that.
There's also sort of like something he doesn't say, and I wonder how he works it out, right? Because what that means is that if everyone had true self-knowledge, everyone would find more or less the same thing.
Well,
maybe in different ways, but, right, we would all sort of fundamentally exist in harmony.
We're making the perfect realistic.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, except in the sense that you might argue that there are, at some point we'd all converge. But that's a level which everyone thinks that all truth converges on. All truth converges. I'm not sure how much that matters. That doesn't bother me so much.
It just doesn't match my experience of humanity. That's all.
Yeah, no, I think that's what you do. You can find that each of us is a fragment of God, and put it all together, and we get your God. And I think
that's what it is. At that point, you can say that even if I have pure self-knowledge, there might be a conflict.
Yeah, right. You could do it that way. I don't have strong feelings that way. I like it a little better, but I can't. I would probably call the formulation such that every human being has potential and every other human being within them, but. Again, but experience limits you. And so you can only, after a certain point, you can only, right, which is the first moment, you can only have your experience.
And all experience limits is your self-knowledge, not...
That's right. And so since everyone, not every human being, not every self is limited by definition, but self-knowledge is limited by definition. Right, self-expression is limited by definition, by combination of experience and embodiment. Right, but embodiment is something that I struggle with and I haven't wrote down. I mean, when I first did it, I think when I was on the panel, was there a Benitsky. one of the speakers was an embodiment. Embodiment is Judaism, so I just started thinking about it. I found it pointing out that Jewish tradition frequently contradicts itself about the nature of the self. It's fun to think something like Modani, in which the self is the body, the self is the Buddha, and the Neshama is something externally imposed in the booth, and the kind of Shemash Nasat to be, right? We talk about the body as the self, and certainly not the other places. We talk about the self as the Neshama, and the body is just the Wubush. I don't think that we have any kind of worked out coherent theology of embodiment as much as it would be fun. I doubt I'm going to solve that one. Alright, apparently I stopped everyone's position. Okay, so those of us.